Cut off your hair and cast it away. That is not the opening of an announcement from the Dean of Students. That is the opening of our text, Jeremiah 7, 29 through 34. Jeremiah has been commanded by God to stand in the gate, there where the leaders of the city and the nation do business. Tell these fellows something, and this is what he is to tell them. Cut off your hair and cast it away, and take up a lamentation on the bare heights. We, with some difficulty, date this magnificent sermon by Jeremiah, probably during the reign of Josiah, perhaps in the early days of Jehoiakim. The Assyrian Empire is crumbling. Judah has been released from its iron grip, as well as have other small nations in the west. It's a crucial time in the history of Judah, as well as in all the nations in the Mesopotamian and Mediterranean worlds. Judah has been led into great spiritual bankruptcy. A former king, Manasseh, had encouraged the revival of the old Canaanite religions and imported the Syrian gods. And Judah was morally bankrupt. The nation was ruptured by crime and adultery. Human life wasn't worth a lead shekel. And the moral bankruptcy and the spiritual bankruptcy combined in perhaps the greatest sin that a nation can perform or can be guilty of. Spiritual and moral bankruptcy, two sides of the same coin. And the prophets speak out against one of the most hateful and condemned practices ever to rear its satanic head among the people of God. It's the kind of thing a nation can get into only when it has reached the bottom of the ladder, morally and spiritually. My message today is on abortion. This text is not specifically about abortion, but the evident parallels bring it to my attention, and I hope to bring it to your attention, because the kind of thing that Judah was doing, about which Jeremiah spoke when he stood in the gate, is the kind of thing that's going on today. And I challenge the church to stand in the gate. Now, verses 29 through 32 we read, "Cut off your hair and cast it away." The figure here is of a widow, a woman who has been divorced and left destitute in the streets. She cuts off her hair as a sign of humiliation and despair. The daughter of Zion has been divorced by God because she has committed spiritual idolatry. She has done it with the pagan gods, and she has done it one time too many. And God says to her, it's time to cut your hair and hit the street and mourn and be humiliated because you've gone too far. You've crossed the line. For the Lord has rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. What an awful thing to say about a nation in any generation. This is the generation of his wrath. For the sons of Judah have done that which is evil in my sight, declares the Lord. They have set their detestable things in the house which is called by my name to defile it. And they have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of Hinnom, of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, and it did not come into my mind. It wasn't my idea. Isn't the kind of thing that I am for. They're doing it in my name sometimes, in the name of religion, but I'm not in it. Now, the reference here, of course, is to a high place of Tophet, a place of child sacrifice, infant sacrifice, that had been set up in the valley of Hinnom. The traditional translation is that they made their sons and daughters pass through the fire to Molech. That translation may have to be rethought. There's a possibility that the spelling is the same, that they were talking about a milk, M-L-K, sacrifice, transliterated. And that the god to which these children were sacrificed was one of the Baals, or it may just be that Moloch was sometimes classified among the Baals. That's neither here nor there. But the point is that they were offering their children, burning them alive as offerings to pagan gods. In December of 1921 in Carthage, the largest cemetery of sacrificed humans ever discovered was found. It held the horrible evidence of nearly 600 years of continuous child sacrifice. And the people of Carthage are the Phoenician or Canaanite peoples, the same outfit that the children of Israel did business with there in what we now call Palestine. Excavators there, because of the references in such texts as ours, they call this children's cemetery the Tophet, place where you bury the babies. This, the one in Carthage, and by the way, there are others. They're in Sicily and Sardinia and Tunisia. But the one in Carthage was measured 54,000 by 64,000 square feet and held as many as 20,000 urns in which the charred remains of burned babies were buried. The Greek author Clitarchus, who wrote in the 3rd century B.C., tells us about the Carthaginians, these Phoenician peoples. He wrote, out of the reverence for Cronos, which was the Greek name for Baal Hamon, one of the Baal gods, the Phoenicians, and especially the Carthaginians, Clitarchus writes, whenever they seek to obtain some great favor, vow one of their children, this is known as the Tophet vow, burning it as a sacrifice to the deity. If they are especially eager to gain success, there stands, when they want to gain success in some kind of venture, or to thank God for something, there stands in their midst a bronze statue of Cronos, this Baal god, its hands extended over a bronze fire bowl, the flames of which engulf the child. When the flames fall upon the body, the limbs contract and the open mouth seems almost to be laughing until the contracted body slips quietly into the pit. Thus it is that the grin is sardonic. The reference here is that in Sardinia there grew a plant that was a poison and it caused bodily convulsions which almost seemed like laughter. So a sardonic laugh was a false laugh. And so he says this grin into which the face of the babies was contorted was called sardonic. Why? Because they seemed to be laughing and they seemed to die laughing, Clitarchus says. And evidence of this god Baal Hamon has been found at Hazar, which predates the Tophet in Carthage by 1,000 years and puts us back near the time that we're talking about in the days of Jeremiah. That is, this great degeneracy moved, as it always did, from east to west. Why did they kill their children? Well, to fulfill the Tophet vow, to gain the favor of the god, the most common reason. Recent studies have shown that there were sociological reasons. That is, and recent work by French historians has suggested that the Phoenician ritual was also a hedge against poverty. They say that because the children were killed in other ways, and child abandonment always went up in tough years financially. Also, the suggestion is, and can prove this, that families of wealth may have controlled the number of their offspring because the fewer offspring they had, the less problem they had with inheritance. And they used this child ritual to keep their family size down. Thus, this ritual sacrifice to the babies was simply one of many forms of infanticide, others being exposure, drowning, starvation, strangulation, smothering, poisoning, and simple neglect. That's what we do in Indiana. We just neglect them. And they die. In 1953, the French scholar Fouvier published several inscriptions dating from the 2nd century B.C., and it sheds a slightly different light on the infant sacrifice at Carthage. A mother named Bisabael thanks Baal Hamon and the goddess Tanit, his consort, for giving her a baby, quote, in exchange for a defective child. Another, a man named Tuscus, declares that he gave Baal, quote, his mute son, and he names him, a defective child in exchange for a heavenly one. Interesting. But sometimes they would have a child they didn't want because it was defective. Maybe it was the wrong sex. They got a girl and they wanted a boy. They got a cripple and they wanted a whole child. So they gave Baal, burned alive, the defective child, and Baal gave them another. And they thanked the god for that. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? You just keep killing them till you get a keeper. And you see why I say these are evident parallels between Carthaginian, Phoenician, Canaanite child sacrifice and abortion as is practiced in the Western world today. America is earning a new symbol. I think it's ironically symbolic that the Statue of Liberty is disintegrating. It's having to be shored up. We might want to just let it fall down and erect a Baal if we keep at it. You see, only 20,000 babies were buried in Carthage. America is approaching 20 million. We make the Carthaginians look like a bunch of Sunday school superintendents. In 1973, Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton, these two landmark decisions, in these the Supreme Court in 72 decisions overturned virtually every existing abortion law in America. And regardless of the pious protestations of the pro-death people, who said they were only interested in abortion extreme cases, just the rare cases of rape or incest or something like that, the law actually permits the abortion of the child at any time during the pregnancy, right up to the day of delivery. All that is required is that the baby is still living inside the mother. The mother wants the baby killed, and the doctor will do it. And what is the result? Abortion in extreme cases? No, we're approaching 20 million. What we have as a result is the slaughter of the infants. Herod would have been proud. We have what the prophets call the shedding of innocent blood. We have the American Holocaust. We have perhaps the generation of his wrath. I wonder if America thinks God is going to put up with this business. I think we need to stand in the gate and say he probably won't, not very long. And so we practice sociological child killing. The Carthaginians and the Phoenicians and the Canaanites were better. They did it primarily for religious reasons, not just matters of convenience. But we, as Americans, we do it primarily for convenience. Stand in the gate. In the gate, in the Supreme Court, the law has been changed. We have been given a new constitution which permits the slaughter of the infants. Gone, ever gone, is the constitutional guarantee of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Our forefathers said that of man that he has certain rights that cannot be taken away, inalienable rights. By that they meant because man is a creation of God. That's what they said. Because man is created by God, he has certain rights that no one can take away. It is the job of the government to protect these rights. But Oliver Wendell Holmes, the social Darwinist, the early part, died about 1935. He changed all that and gave us a new constitution. He decreed that man, who has no more rights than a rattlesnake, man's just an animal, he's categorically has no more constitutional rights than a plant, a petunia, that the human rights, including the right to life, must be defended only insofar as the defense of those rights hinder the proper evolution of the state. And then when the day comes that any right hinders the proper evolution of the state, it can be taken away, and it must be taken away. And that's exactly what's being done. And I won't go into that, and I won't have time, but simply to point out that we are in America no longer under constitutional law. We are under sociological law. And so being under sociological law, we are permitted sociological child killing, not religious child killing. That is simply for convenience. You see, our Supreme Court has decided that it's better for the state if we kill 1.7 million babies a year. Well, pro-death people resist attempts to have a law passed that would really tell the mother what abortion really is before she chooses an abortion. I reject the euphemisms of abortion. I list some of them here. Removal of the products of conception. I like that. It's called prevention. It does that. It's not a baby, it's fetal material. Abortion is a simple medical procedure, not unlike having a wart removed. My favorite is the lady who's the leader in Washington in the pro-choice movement, it's called. She calls it aborting the mother. I got news for her. It's not the mother who's aborted. She goes home. It's the baby that goes down the toilet. And so by semantic fraud, the unborn is reduced to the status of an infected appendix or a lump of undigested hamburger in the stomach of the mother. That's not what's going on. What is abortion? Abortion is a 12-week fetus with all organisms functional. This unborn person breathes, swallows, digests, and urinates. He's very sensitive to pain, recoils from a pinprick. His psychosomatic self is well underway. He's been caught sucking his thumb. One day a curette, a tiny hole-like tool, comes at him through his mother's dilated cervix. The instrument gouges his writhing body into bloody chunks and drags him in pieces from the uterus. The operating nurse stands by to reassemble the baby to make sure it's all there. Otherwise, the mother might become infected. We wouldn't want that. What is abortion? It's a 19-week fetus that is a baby with facial expressions. Fine hairs begin to grow on the head, and the eyebrows and eyelashes are evident. The heart can be plainly heard. Its mother is just beginning to show, as we call it. Suddenly, a long needle injects salt into the amniotic fluid in which the child is floating. The baby breathes in and swallows the salt and is gradually poisoned. And while it's dying, the outer layer of its skin is burned off. See? The babies are literally burned alive. It takes an excruciating hour for the baby to die. At least the Canaanites did it suddenly. They didn't make the baby suffer for an hour. About a day later, the mother goes into labor and delivers the wretched, tortured corpse. Many physicians prefer this method because they don't have to be there when the body arrives. They inject the salt and leave it for the nurse to dispose of the body. What is abortion? It's a 24-week baby that could very well survive if the mother delivered prematurely, but she undergoes a hysterotomy, which is simply a C-section until the baby comes out, and there's a difference. If it's a C-section, the phlegm is sucked out of the baby's respiratory system and it goes to the child care unit. If it's a hysterotomy, they throw it in a bucket. In a hysterotomy, the victim is dropped into a pan or sink and left to die. It struggles to breathe. Some cry. If the infant is too vigorous and won't die quick enough, then the doctor has to smother or strangle it. And there's the Upjohn special. This is an abortion procedure that uses the chemicals developed and promoted, sold by the Upjohn Company. A hormone is injected into the mother. She begins to contract intensely, pushing the fetus out. Babies have been decapitated during these abnormal contractions. Many are born alive, and several mothers have died from this. Well, 2 years ago, two bills were introduced in the Florida legislature to require that fetuses be anesthetized before they're burned or cut to pieces. And the Women's Health Organization opposed anesthetizing the fetus. Why? Well, they said that only 2% of the abortions are performed after the first trimester, the first 3 months, which is not true. But even if it were true, taking their numbers, 2% of 1.7 million is 34,000 tortured, agonizing babies a year. The ACLU, who else, warned that if the bill were passed, they would challenge it in court. Why? Because it's unconstitutional to anesthetize the unborn. Well, abortion and society. We have sociological law, sociological abortion, 1.7 a year. It's the most common medical procedure performed on adults now. One in three pregnancies, one in three, ended by abortion. 97% are for pure convenience, perhaps higher. 3% are for rape, incest, or a defective child. And that needs to be talked about because many of these children are not defective, or they have some slight defect. Abortion is being pushed by Planned Parenthood in the schools. In one study of 500 women who had abortions, only 6% have been using birth control. That is, they were simply using abortion as their method of birth control. Over 30% of those having abortions have had them before. You see, when the law was passed, the proponents of this death policy said, well, it's just to get a woman out of a one-time tough situation. The women are having two and three and four abortions. There are many myths and lies pushed by the pro-death people. I would point out that back alley abortions have not been reduced. They've been increased. Pregnancy almost never results from a criminal rape. The law was passed, abortion in case of criminal rape almost never happened. And if it does happen, and when it does, it's not right. And a nation that will not punish the rapist seriously should not put the baby to death. It is not the baby who's guilty. Do you realize that the argument is, well, to save the life of the mother, do you realize that most pediatric surgeons have lived it through their whole careers, practiced medicine for 30 and 40 years, and have never seen a case where a choice had to be made between the mother and the baby? That's a myth. It almost never happens. Abortion is not medically safer than childbirth. There is no connection between unwanted children and child abuse. Absolutely no connection. Most children, by the way, are unwanted. Most pregnancies are unwanted in the beginning. But the reason adults abuse their children is because they themselves were abused, not because they didn't want them. That is, most abused babies are wanted children. There's no connection between unwanted pregnancies, and child abuse. And I simply refuse to take seriously the argument of somebody who says, well, we must kill them so they won't be abused. Anybody who's in favor of salt poisoning has nothing whatever to say about child abuse. It's not to me. Abortion does not decrease the number of defective children. It increases them because after a woman has an abortion, her chances of having a defective child the next time she tries skyrocket. What is the moral impact? What happens to a nation? How did that generation in our text become the generation of his wrath? Well, because when we start killing the little ones, something happens to us as well as to the babies. What would we say of a mother who gets on the phone one day and calls up a man, a known murderer, and says, I got a baby in my nursery. It's a month old, and I decide I don't want it. I want you to come in and set fire to it. I want you to come in and drown it in salt water, some acid that will eat its skin off. I want you to bring a knife and a saw and cut it up while it's alive and get rid of it for me. What would we say about that woman? Is there any real difference if she says the same thing to her doctor a month before the baby is born? Or 2 months, or 6 months before the baby is born. Abortion is murder. More than once a day, on the average, more than once a day in America, a baby is aborted who has the temerity to live. The little rascal just won't die. And according to the new Constitution, it is a person now. It is postnatal. It has the guarantees of protection. Are they protected? No. They're strangled or abandoned. And where is the ACLU? Silent as the tomb. As I said before, Herod the Great is the patron saint of the American Civil Liberties Union. And the church, if a church ever excommunicated anybody, the church ought to excommunicate church members who are members of the ACLU or Planned Parenthood or some of these organizations. Bernard Nathanson, we're talking about what happens to us morally. Bernard Nathanson, who's a famous physician who used to be an abortionist, was for years and is no longer. He raises the question about the hypothetical woman who has her fifth-month fetus, which is perfectly legal, by the way, has her fifth-month fetus aborted out of pure curiosity. She wants to see what it looks like, and she has it bronzed and put on her coffee table as a conversation piece. Well, even the pro-choice people back off at that kind of choice, and yet he points out that, as a matter of fact, a woman did come to him for an abortion because she had planned a trip to Europe and didn't want to be inconvenienced. I call what is happening the Hitlerization of America. You see, once life is trivialized, it's trivialized, and there's no going back. Once we agree to solve social problems by eliminating people, there's nothing left for us to do to make sure that we ourselves do not become social problems. After World War II, students from all over Europe flocked in to hear the lectures of Helmut Thielicke. They wanted to know how the Holocaust could have happened. He told them this: once a man ceases to recognize the infinite value of the human soul, then all he can recognize is that man is something to be used. But then he will also have to go further and recognize that some men can no longer be used. And he arrives at the concept that there are some lives that have no value at all. Nobody can be preserved from this ultimate conclusion by a peaceable character or because he can't stand to see blood. Once we make that decision about the unborn, we have made a decision about ourselves. Jeremiah 7:31 we read, "And they have built the high places of Tophet, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire, which I did not command, and it did not come into my mind. It is not the will of God." The Bible assumes the personhood of the fetus. Man is in the image of God. He is not an animal. Man has the potential for a relationship with his Creator. There is no sliding scale. When does life begin? It begins at conception. And The unborn and the 60-year-old have this capacity for fellowship with God, and the unborn and the 60-year-old are both people. The right of the child to live overcomes the right of the mother to choose to kill it. And we are not surprised to read in the Bible that the killing of a person is not the slaughter of livestock, it's not the hunting of game, it's murder. In Psalm 139 we read, "For thou didst form my inward parts, thou didst weave me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." The Bible attributes personhood and identity to the fetus. The New Testament word brephos for a baby is used both for the born and the unborn. The unborn is a baby just like the born in the Bible. The early church stood in the gate and said, "Let's not kill the kids anymore." Abortion was very common in the ancient world, and most of the methods that are used today were used then. And the early church opposed it bitterly and decisively. Tertullian summarizes for us the Christian view. He says, "In our case, murder, being once for all forbidden, we may not destroy even the fetus in the womb. To hinder a birth is merely a speedier man-killing. Nor does it matter whether you take away a life that is born or destroy one that is coming to birth. That is a man which is going to be one. You have the fruit already in the seed." When the early church changed its society, and one of the first businesses to which the early church gave itself was to the stopping of abortion. But what is the church doing today? Is it standing in the gate? C. Everett Koop, our Surgeon General, writes this: "Abortion, the whole issue, has been foisted upon us through deception. Its advocates have convinced much of the American public and the courts that abortion concerns a fetus that is not a person in the true sense, that it concerns a woman's right of privacy, and that the issue is political and social rather than personal or moral. The Supreme Court has championed these views. The secular public has split down the middle. Pro-life groups flex muscles in major cities. But the evangelical church, which should be seething with outrage and storming the nation in protest, still waits in the wings trying to make up its mind." Right to Life stands in the gate. Many of those are Christians. I'm humiliated at that. There ought not to be elbow room in the gate. There ought to be so many Christians there. Our voice ought to be so loud they'd be sick of hearing us. And what if we don't? Well, we look at the last part of our text. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, verse 32, when it will no more be called Topheth, or the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they will bury in Topheth, because there is no other place. And the dead bodies of this people will be food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth, and no one will frighten them away. Then I will make to cease from the cities of Judah and from the streets of Jerusalem the voice of joy and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, for the land will become a ruin. What's he saying? Jeremiah stood in the gate and spoke the word of the Lord and said this: you see that valley of Hinnom outside Jerusalem where you kill the babies? And it's going to be called the valley of slaughter from now on, because that's where I'm going to bury the nation. Where you've buried the kids, I'm going to bury the nation. And where are the little ones going? They're going in the garbage cans and the dumpsters and into the septic tanks. And I had the high opinion that that's where God is going to send our nation if we do not repent and preserve the little ones. America is becoming a Topheth. And perhaps God would warn America as Jeremiah warned Judah. And perhaps God would do it through the church, through you and me, that the garbage cans and the dumpsters, which are the cemetery of the little ones, will be the fate of our nation. Jesus said, be careful how you treat the children. I love this text. Be careful how you treat the children. Why? Their angel always has the attention of the Heavenly Father. I wonder what the angels of the 1.7 million unborn a year are saying to God about it. Let's stand in the gate. Let's stand there for the Constitution. Let's stand there for cultural survival. Let's stand there for reason. Let's stand there for God. And let's stand there and preach the word of the Lord for the little ones.